armaments intended to kill American soldiers? Would we have let it pass? It was a good question, and Gus had no reasonable answer. He said, Well, Secretary of State Bryan agreed with you. William Jennings Bryan had resigned over Wilson's note to the Germans. He thought all we needed to do was warn Americans not to travel on the ships of combatant nations. She was not willing to let him off the hook. Bryan sees that Wilson has taken a grave risk, she said. If the Germans don't back down now, we can hardly avoid war with them. Gus was not going to admit to a journalist that he shared these misgivings. Wilson had demanded that the German government disavow the attacks on merchant shipping, make reparations, and prevent any recurrence. In other words, allow the British the freedom of the seas, while accepting that Germany's own ships were trapped in dock by the blockade. It was hard to see any government agreeing to such demands. But public opinion approves what the president has done. Public opinion can be wrong, but the president can't ignore it. Look, Wilson is walking a tightrope. He wants to keep us out of the war, but he doesn't want America to appear weak in international diplomacy. I think he struck the right balance for the present. But in the future? That was the worrying question. No one can predict the future, Gus said. Not even Woodrow Wilson. She laughed. A politician's answer. You'll go far in Washington. Someone spoke to her and she turned away. Gus moved off, feeling a bit as if he had been in a boxing match that had ended in a draw. Some of the audience were invited to take tea with the lecturer. Gus was among the privileged because his mother was a patron of the museum. He left Rosa and headed for a private room. When he entered, he was delighted to see Olga there. No doubt her father also gave money. He got a cup of tea and then approached her. If you're ever in Washington, I'd love to show you around the White House, he said. Oh, could you introduce me to the president? He wanted to say yes, anything, but he hesitated to promise what he might not be able to deliver. Probably, he said. It would depend on how busy he happened to be. When he gets behind that typewriter and starts to write speeches or press releases, no one is allowed to disturb him.
I was so sad when his wife passed away, Olga said.
Ellen Wilson had died almost a year ago, shortly after the outbreak of war in Europe. Gus nodded. He was devastated.
But I hear he's romancing a wealthy widow already.
Gus was discomfited. It was an open secret in Washington that Wilson had fallen passionately, boyishly in love, only 8 months after the death of his wife, with the voluptuous Mrs. Edith Galt. The president was 58, his paramour 41. Right now they were together in New Hampshire. Gus was among a very small group who also knew that Wilson had proposed marriage a month ago, but Mrs. Galt had not yet given him an answer. He said to Olga, "Who told you that?
Is it true?"
He was desperate to impress her with his inside knowledge, but he managed to resist the temptation. "I can't talk about that sort of thing," he said reluctantly.
"Oh, how disappointing. I was hoping you'd give me the inside gossip."
"I'm sorry to be such a letdown."
"Don't be silly."
She touched his arm, giving him a thrill like an electric shock.
"I'm having a tennis party tomorrow afternoon," she said. "Do you play?"
Gus had long arms and legs and was a fairly good player.
"I do,"
he said. "I love the game."
"Will you come?"
"I'd be delighted," he said. 3. Lev learned to drive in a day. The other main skill of a chauffeur, changing punctured tires, took him a couple of hours to master. By the end of a week he could also fill the tank, change the oil, and adjust the brakes. If the car would not go, he knew how to check for a flat battery or a blocked fuel line. Horses were the transport of the past, Joseph Vyalov told him. Stable hands were low paid. There were plenty of them. Chauffeurs were scarce and earned high wages. In addition, Vyalov liked to have a driver who was tough enough to double as a bodyguard. Vyalov's car was a brand-new Packard Twin 6, a 7-passenger limousine. Other chauffeurs were impressed. The model had been launched only a few weeks ago, and its 12-cylinder engine was the envy even of drivers of the Cadillac V8. Lev was not so taken with Vyalov's ultra-modern mansion. To him it looked like the world's largest cowshed. It was long and low, with broad, overhanging eaves. The head gardener told him it was a prairie house, in the latest fashion.
If I had a house this big, I'd want it to look like a palace, Lev said. He thought of writing to Grigorian, telling him all about Buffalo and the job and the car, but he hesitated. He would want to say that he had put aside some money for Grigori's ticket, but in fact he had nothing saved. When he had a little stash, he would write, he vowed. Meanwhile, Grigori could not write because he did not know Lev's address. There were three people in the Vyalov family: Joseph himself, his wife Lena, who rarely spoke, and Olga, a pretty daughter of about Lev's age, with a bold look in her eye. Joseph was attentive and courteous with his wife, even though he spent most evenings out with his cronies. To his daughter he was affectionate but strict. He often drove home at midday to have lunch with Lena and Olga. After lunch he and Lena would take a nap. While Lev was waiting to drive Joseph back downtown, he sometimes talked to Olga. She liked to smoke cigarettes, something that was forbidden by her father, who was fiercely determined that she should be a respectable young lady and marry into the Buffalo social elite. There were a few places on the property where Joseph never went, and the garage was one of them, so Olga came there to smoke. She would sit in the back seat of the Packard, her silk dress on the new leather, and Lev would lean on the door with his foot up on the running board and chat to her. He was aware that he looked handsome in the chauffeur's uniform, and he wore the cap tilted jauntily back. He soon discovered that the way to please Olga was to compliment her on being high class. She loved to be told that she walked like a princess, talked like a president's wife, and dressed like a Parisian socialite. She was a snob, and so was her father. Most of the time, Joseph was a bully and a thug, but Lev noticed how he became well-mannered, almost deferential, when talking to high-status men such as bank presidents and congressmen. Lev had a quick intuition, and soon had Olga figured out. She was an overprotected rich girl who had no outlet for her natural romantic and sexual impulses. Unlike the girls Lev had known in the slums of St. Petersburg, Olga could not slip out to meet a boy at twilight and let him feel her up in the darkness of a shop doorway. She was 20 years old and a virgin. It was even possible she had never been kissed. Lev watched the tennis party from a distance, drinking in the sight of Olga's strong, slim body, and the way her breasts moved under the light cotton of her dress as she flew across the court. She was playing against a very tall man in white flannel trousers. Lev felt a jolt of recognition. Staring at the man, he eventually recalled where he had seen him before. It was at the Putilov Works. Lev had tricked him out of a dollar, and Grigori had asked him if Joseph Vyalev really was a big man in Buffalo. What was his name? It was the same as a brand of whiskey. Dewar. That was it. Gus Dewar. A group of half a dozen young people were watching the game, the girls in bright summer dresses, the men wearing straw boaters. Mrs. Vyalov looked out from under her parasol with a pleased smile. A uniformed maid was serving lemonade. Gus Dewar defeated Olga and they left the court. Their places were immediately taken by another couple. Olga daringly accepted a cigarette from her opponent. Lev watched him light it for her. Lev ached to be one of them, playing tennis in beautiful clothes and drinking lemonade. A wild stroke sent the ball his way. He picked it up and, instead of throwing it back, carried it to the court and handed it to one of the players. He looked at Olga. She was deep in conversation with Dewar, charming him in a flirtatious way, just as she did with Lev in the garage. He felt a stab of jealousy and wanted to punch the tall guy in the mouth. He caught Olga's eye and gave her his most charming smile, but she looked away without acknowledging him. The other young people totally ignored him. It was perfectly normal, he told himself. A girl could be friendly with the chauffeur while smoking in the garage, then treat him like a piece of furniture when she was with her friends. All the same, his pride was wounded. He turned away and saw her father walking down the gravel path toward the tennis court. Vyalov was dressed for business in a lounge suit with a waistcoat. He had come to greet his daughter's guests before returning downtown, Lev guessed. Any second now he would see Olga smoking, and then there would be hell to pay. Lev was inspired. In two strides, he crossed to where Olga was sitting. With a swift motion, he snatched the lighted cigarette from between her fingers. "Hey!" she protested. Gus Dewar frowned and said, "What the devil are you up to?" Lev turned away, putting the cigarette between his lips. A moment later, Vyalov spotted him. "What are you doing here?" he said crossly. "Get my car out."
"Yes, sir," said Lev.
"And put out that damned cigarette when you're talking to me." Lev pinched out the coal and put the butt in his pocket. "Sorry, Mr. Vyalov, sir. I forgot myself. Don't let it happen again."
"Yes, sir.
Now clear off." Lev hurried away, then looked back over his shoulder. The young men had jumped to their feet, and Vyalov was jovially shaking hands all round. Olga, looking guilty, was introducing her friends. She had almost been caught. She met Lev's eye and shot him a grateful look. Lev winked at her and walked on. 4. Ursula Dewar's drawing room contained a few ornaments, all precious in different ways. A marble head by Ely Nadelman, a first edition of the Geneva Bible, a single rose in a cut glass vase, and a framed photograph of her grandfather, who had opened one of the first department stores in America. When Gus came into the room at 6 o'clock, she was sitting in a silk evening dress, reading a new novel called The Good Soldier. "How's the book?" he asked her.
"It is extraordinarily good, although I hear, paradoxically, that the author is a frightful cad."
He mixed an old-fashioned for her, the way she liked it, with bitters but no sugar. He felt nervous. "At my age, I shouldn't be afraid of my mother," he thought. But she could be scathing. He handed her the drink.
"Thank you," she said.
"Are you enjoying your summer break?"
"Very much. I was afraid that by now you'd be itching to get back to the excitement of Washington and the White House."
Gus had expected that, too. But the holiday had brought unexpected pleasures. "I'll return as soon as the president does. But meanwhile, I'm having a great time."
"Is Woodrow going to declare war on Germany, do you think?"
"I hope not. The Germans are willing to back down, but they want Americans to stop selling arms to the Allies."
"And will we stop?"
Ursula was of German ancestry, as were some half the population of Buffalo. But when she said, "we," she meant America. "Absolutely not. Our factories are making too much money from British orders."
"Is it a deadlock, then?"
"Not yet. We're still dancing around one another. Meanwhile, as if to remind us of the pressures on neutral countries, Italy has joined the Allies."
"Will that make any difference?"
"Not enough." Gus took a deep breath. "I played tennis at the Vyalovs' place this afternoon," he said. His voice did not sound as casual as he had hoped.
"Did you win, dear?"
"Yes. They have a prairie house. It's very striking."
"So nouveau riche."
"I suppose we were nouveau riche once, weren't we? Perhaps when your grandfather opened his store."
"I find it tiresome when you talk like a socialist, Angus, even though I know you don't mean it."
She sipped her drink.
This is perfect."
He took a deep breath.
"Mother,
would you do something for me?"
"Of course, dear, if I can."
"You won't like it."
"What is it?"
"I want you to invite Mrs. Vyalov to tea." His mother put her drink down slowly and carefully.
"I see,"
she said. "Aren't you going to ask why?"
"I know why,"
she said. "There is only one possible reason. I have met the ravishingly pretty daughter." "You're not to be cross. Vyalov is a leading man in this city, and very wealthy, and Olga is an angel.
Or, if not an angel, at least a Christian."
"The Vyalovs are Russian Orthodox," Gus said. Might as well get all the bad news on the table, he thought. "They go to the Church of St. Peter and Paul on Ideal Street. The Duers were Episcopalians, but not Jewish, thank God." Mother had once feared that Gus might marry Rachel Abramoff, whom he had liked enormously but never loved.
"And I suppose we can be grateful that Olga is not a fortune hunter."
"Indeed not. I should think Vyalov must be richer than father."
"I'm sure I have no idea."
Women such as Ursula were not supposed to know about money. Gus suspected they knew the net worth of their own and each other's husbands to the nearest dime, but they had to pretend ignorance. She was not as cross as he had feared. "So you'll do it," he said with trepidation.
"Of course. I'll send Mrs. Vyalov a note."
Gus felt elated, but a new fear struck him. "Mind you, you're not to invite your snobbish friends to make Mrs. Vyalov feel inferior."
"I have no snobbish friends."
That remark was too ludicrous even to be acknowledged.
"Ask Mrs. Fisher. She's amiable. And Aunt Gertrude."
"Very well. Thank you, Mother."
Gus felt great relief, as if he had survived an ordeal. I know Olga is not the bride you may have dreamed of for me, but I feel sure you're going to become very fond of her in no time at all.
My dear son, you're almost 26 years old.
5 years ago I might have tried to talk you out of marriage to the daughter of a shady businessman, but lately I have been wondering if I'm ever to have grandchildren. If at this point you announced that you wanted to marry a divorced Polish waitress, I fear my first concern might be whether she were young enough to bear children.
Don't jump the gun. Olga hasn't agreed to marry me. I haven't even asked her.
How could she resist you?
She stood up and kissed him.
Now make me another drink.
5. You saved my life, Olga said to Lev. Father would have killed me.
Lev grinned. I saw him coming. I had to act first.
I'm so grateful,
Olga said, and she kissed his lips.
He was startled. She pulled away before he could take advantage, but he felt himself to be on a completely different footing with her immediately. He looked nervously around the garage, but they were alone. She took out a pack of cigarettes and put one in her mouth. He lit it, copying what Gus Duer had done yesterday. It was an intimate gesture, obliging the woman to dip her head and allowing the man to stare at her lips. It felt romantic. She leaned back in the seat of the Packard and blew out smoke. Lev got into the car and sat beside her. She made no objection. He lit a cigarette for himself. They sat for a while in the half-dark, their smoke mingling with the smells of oil and leather and a flowery perfume Olga was wearing. To break the silence, Lev said, "I hope you enjoyed your tennis party." She sighed. "All the boys in this town are frightened of my father," she said. "They think he'll shoot them if they kiss me."
"Will he shoot them?"
She laughed.
"Probably.
I'm not afraid of him."
This was near to the truth. Lev was not really unafraid. He just ignored his fears, always hoping he could talk his way out of trouble. But she looked skeptical.
"Really?"
"That's why he hired me."
This too was only one step removed from reality.
"Ask him."
"I might do that."
"Gus Duer really likes you."
"My father would love it if I married him."
"Why?"
"He's rich. His family are old Buffalo aristocracy, and his father is a senator."
"Do you always do what your pa wants?"
She drew thoughtfully on her cigarette.
"Yes,"
she said, and blew out smoke. Lev said, "I love to watch your lips when you smoke." She made no reply, but gave him a speculative look. That was invitation enough for Lev, and he kissed her. She gave a little moan at the back of her throat, and pushed feebly at his chest with her hand, but neither protest was serious. He tossed his cigarette out of the car and put his hand on her breast. She grasped his wrist, as if to shove his hand away, then instead pressed it harder against her soft flesh. Lev touched her closed lips with his tongue. She pulled away and gave him a startled look. He realized she did not know about kissing this way. She really was inexperienced.
"It's okay," he said. "Trust me."
She threw away her cigarette, pulled him nearer, closed her eyes and kissed him with her mouth open. After that, it happened very fast. There was a desperate urgency about her desire. Lev had been with several women, and he believed it was wise to let them set the pace. A hesitant woman could not be hurried, and an impatient one should not be held back. When he found his way through Olga's underwear and stroked the soft mound of her sex, she became so aroused that she sobbed with passion. If it were true that she had reached the age of 20 without being kissed by any of the timid boys of Buffalo, she must have a lot of stored-up frustration, he guessed. She lifted her hips eagerly for him to pull down her drawers. When he kissed her between her legs, she cried out with shock and excitement. She had to be a virgin, but he was too heated for such a thought to give him pause. She lay back with one foot on the seat and the other on the floor, her skirt around her waist. Her thighs spread ready for him. Her mouth was open and she was breathing hard. She watched him with wide eyes as he unbuttoned. He entered her cautiously, knowing how easy it was to hurt a girl there. But she grasped his hips and pulled him inside her impatiently, as if she feared she might be cheated at the last minute of what she wanted. He felt the membrane of her virginity resist him briefly, then break easily, with only a little gasp from her, as of a tinge of pain that went as quickly as it had come. She moved against him in a rhythm of her own, and again he let her take the lead, sensing that she was answering a call that would not be denied. This was more thrilling for him than the act of love had ever been before. Some girls were knowing, some were innocent, but keen to please. Some were careful to satisfy the man before seeking their own fulfillment. But Lev had never come across such raw need as Olga's, and it inflamed him beyond measure. He held himself back. Olga cried out loud, and she put a hand over her mouth to muffle the sound. She bucked like a pony, then buried her face in his shoulder. With a stifled scream, she reached her climax, and a moment later he did the same. He rolled off her and sat on the floor. She lay still, panting. Neither of them spoke for a minute. Eventually, she sat upright. "Oh, God," she said. "I didn't know it would be like that."
"Usually it's not," he replied.
There was a long, reflective pause. Then she said in a quieter voice, "What have I done?" He made no answer. She picked up her drawers from the floor of the car and pulled them on. She sat still a moment longer, catching her breath. Then she got out of the car. Lev stared at her, waiting for her to say something, but she did not. She walked to the rear door of the garage, opened it, and went out. But she came back the next day. Six. Edith Galt accepted President Wilson's proposal of marriage on June 29th. In July, the president returned to the White House temporarily.
"I have to go back to Washington for a few days," Gus said to Olga as they strolled through the Buffalo Zoo.
"How many days?"
"As long as the president needs me."
"How thrilling."
Gus nodded. "It's the best job in the world. But it does mean that I'm not my own master. If the crisis with Germany escalates, it could be a long time before I come back to Buffalo."
"We'll miss you."
"And I'll miss you. We've been such pals since I came back." They had gone boating on the lake in Delaware Park and bathing at Crystal Beach. They had taken steamers up the river to Niagara and across the lake to the Canadian side. And they had played tennis every other day, always with a group of young friends and chaperoned by at least one watchful mother. Today, Mrs. Vialov was with them, walking a few paces behind and talking to Chuck Dixon. Gus went on, "I wonder if you have any idea how much I'll miss you." Olga smiled, but made no reply. Gus said, "This has been the happiest summer of my life."
"And mine," she said,
twirling her red and white polka dot parasol. That delighted Gus, although he was not sure it was his company that made her happy. He still could not make her out. She always seemed pleased to see him and was glad to talk to him hour after hour. But he had seen no emotion, no sign that her feelings for him might be passionate rather than merely friendly. Of course, no respectable girl ought to show such signs, at least until she was engaged. But all the same, Gus felt at sea. Perhaps that was part of her appeal. He recalled vividly that Carolyn Wigmore had communicated her needs to him with unmistakable clarity. He found himself thinking a lot about Carolyn, who was the only other woman he had ever loved. If she could say what she wanted, why not Olga? But Carolyn had been a married woman, whereas Olga was a virgin who had had a sheltered upbringing. Gus stopped in front of the bear pit, and they looked through the steel bars at a small brown bear sitting on its haunches staring back at them. "I wonder if all our days could be this happy," Gus said.
"Why not?"
she said. "Was that encouragement?" He looked at her. She did not return his gaze, but watched the bear. He studied her blue eyes, the soft curve of her pink cheek, the delicate skin of her neck.
"I wish I were Titian," he said. "I'd paint you."
Her mother and Chuck went by and strolled on, leaving Gus and Olga behind. They were as alone as they would ever be. She turned her gaze on him at last, and he thought he saw something like fondness in her eyes. That gave him courage. He thought, if a president who has been a widower less than a year can do it, surely I can. He said, "I love you, Olga." She said nothing but continued to look at him. He swallowed. Once again he could not make her out. He said, "Is there any chance? May I hope that one day you might love me too?" He stared at her, holding his breath.
At this moment she held his life in her hands. There was a long pause. Was she thinking, weighing him in the balance, or just hesitating before a life-changing decision? At last she smiled and said, "Oh, yes." He could hardly believe it. "Really?" She laughed happily. "Really?" He took her hand. "Do you love me?" She nodded. "You have to say it." "Yes, Gus. I love you." He kissed her hand. "I'll speak to your father before I go to Washington." She smiled. "I think I know what he will say. After that, we can tell everyone."
"Yes."
"Thank you," he said fervently. "You have made me very happy." 7. Gus called at Joseph Vyalov's office in the morning and formally asked permission to propose to his daughter. Vyalov pronounced himself delighted. Although that was the answer Gus expected, he found himself weak with relief afterward. Gus was on his way to the station to catch a train to Washington, so they agreed to celebrate as soon as he could get back. Meanwhile, Gus was happy to leave it to Olga's mother and his to plan the wedding. Entering Central Station on Exchange Street with a spring in his step, he ran into Rosa Hellman coming out, wearing a red hat, carrying a small overnight bag. "Hello," he said. "May I help you with your luggage?"
"No, thanks. It's light," she said.
"I was only away one night. I went for an interview with one of the wire services." He raised his eyebrows. "For a job as a reporter?"
"Yes,
and I got it." "Congratulations. Forgive me if I sound surprised. I didn't think they employed women writers."
"It's unusual, but not unknown. The New York Times hired its first female reporter in 1869. Her name was Maria Morgan."
"What will you be doing?"
"I'll be the assistant to their Washington correspondent. The truth is, the president's love life has made them think they need a woman there. Men are liable to miss romantic stories."
Gus wondered if she had mentioned that she was friendly with one of Wilson's closest aides. He guessed she had. Reporters were never coy. No doubt it had helped her get the job. "I'm on my way back," he said. "I guess we'll see each other there."
"I hope so.
I have some good news, too," he said happily. "I proposed to Olga Vyalov, and she accepted me. We're getting married." She gave him a long look. Then she said, "You fool." He could not have been more shocked if she had slapped him. He stared at her, open-mouthed. "You goddamn fool," she said, and she walked away. 8. Two more Americans died on August 19th when the Germans torpedoed another large British liner, the Arabic. Gus was sorry for the victims, but even more aghast at America's being pulled inexorably into the European conflict. He felt that the president was on the brink. Gus wanted to get married in a world of peace and happiness. He dreaded a future blighted by the mayhem and cruelty and destruction of war. On Wilson's instructions, Gus told a few reporters off the record that the president was on the point of breaking off diplomatic relations with Germany. Meanwhile, the new Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, tried to make some kind of deal with the German ambassador, Count Johann von Bernstorff. It could go horribly wrong, Gus thought. The Germans could call Wilson's bluff and defy him. Then what would he do? If he did nothing, he would look stupid. He told Gus that breaking off diplomatic relations would not necessarily lead to war. Gus was left with the frightening feeling that the crisis was out of control. But the Kaiser did not want war with America, and, to Gus's immense relief, Wilson's gamble paid off. At the end of August, the Germans promised not to attack passenger ships without warning. It was not a fully satisfactory reassurance, but it ended the standoff. The American newspapers, missing all the nuances, were ecstatic. On September 2nd, Gus triumphantly read aloud to Wilson a paragraph from a laudatory article in that day's New York Evening Post. "Without mobilizing a regiment or assembling a fleet, by sheer dogged, unwavering persistence in advocating the right, he has compelled the surrender of the proudest, the most arrogant, the best armed of nations." "They haven't surrendered yet," said the president. 9. One evening in late September, they took Lev to the warehouse, stripped him naked, and tied his hands behind his back. Then Vyalov came out of his office. "You dog," he said.
You mad dog. What have I done? Lev pleaded. You know what you've done, you filthy cur, said Vyalov. Lev was terrified. He could not talk his way out of this if Vyalov would not listen. Vyalov took off his jacket and rolled up his shirt sleeves. Bring it to me, he said. Norman Niall, his weedy accountant, went into the office and returned with a knout. Lev stared at it. It was the standard ration pattern, traditionally used to punish criminals. It had a long wooden handle and three hardened leather thongs, each terminating in a lead ball. Lev had never been flogged, but he had seen it done. In the countryside, it was a common punishment for petty theft or adultery. In St. Petersburg, the knout was often used on political offenders. 20 lashes could cripple a man. 100 would kill him. Vyalov, still wearing his waistcoat with the gold watch chain, hefted the knout. Niall giggled. Ilya and Theo looked on with interest. Lev cowered away, turning his back, pressing himself up against a stack of tires. The whip came down with a cruel swish, biting into his neck and shoulders, and he screamed in pain. Vyalov brought the whip down again. This time it hurt more. Lev could not believe what a fool he had been. He had fucked the virgin daughter of a powerful and violent man. What had he been thinking of? Why could he never resist temptation? Vyalov lashed again. This time Lev flung himself away from the knout, trying to dodge the blow. Only the very ends of the thongs connected, but they still dug agonizingly into his flesh, and he cried out in pain again. He tried to get away, but Vyalov's men pushed him back, laughing. Vyalov raised the whip again, started to bring it down, stopped in mid-swipe as Lev dodged, then struck. Lev's legs were slashed, and he saw blood pouring from the cuts. When Vyalov lashed again, Lev desperately flung himself away, then stumbled and fell to the concrete floor. As he lay on his back, losing strength rapidly, Vyalov whipped his front, striking his belly and thighs. Lev rolled over, too agonized and terror-struck to get to his feet, but the knout kept coming down. He summoned the energy to crawl a short way on his knees, like a baby, but he slipped in his own blood, and the whip came down again. He stopped screaming. He had no breath. Vyalov was going to flog him to death, he decided. He longed for oblivion to come. But Vyalov denied him that relief. He dropped the knout, panting with exertion. I ought to kill you, he said when he had caught his breath, but I can't. Lev was baffled. He lay in a pool of blood, staring at his torturer. She's pregnant, Vyalov said. In a haze of fear and pain, Lev tried to think. They had used condoms. You could buy them in any big American city. He had always put one on. Except for that first time, of course, when he had not been expecting anything, and the time she had been showing him around the empty house, and they had done it on the big bed in the guest room, and once in the garden after dark. There had been several times, he realized. She was going to marry Senator Duer's boy, Vyalov said, and Lev could hear bitterness as well as rage in his harsh voice. My grandson might have been a president. It was hard for Lev to think straight, but he realized that the wedding would have to be called off. Gus Duer would not marry a girl who was pregnant with someone else's baby, no matter how much he loved her. Unless... Lev managed to croak a few words. She doesn't have to have the baby. There are doctors right here in town. Vyalov snatched up the knout, and Lev cowered away. Vyalov screamed, Never even think about that! It's against the will of God! Lev was amazed. Every Sunday he drove the Vyalov family to church, but he had assumed religion was a sham for Joseph. The man lived by dishonesty and violence, yet he could not bear to hear mention of abortion. Lev wanted to ask whether his church did not prohibit bribery and beating people up. Vyalov said, Can you imagine the humiliation you're causing me? Every newspaper in town reported the engagement. His face reddened and his voice rose to a roar. What am I going to say to Senator Duer? I've booked the church. I've hired caterers. The invitations are at the printers. I can just see Mrs. Duer, that proud old cunt, laughing at me behind her wrinkled hand, and all because of a fucking chauffeur. He raised the knout again, then threw it away with a violent gesture. I can't kill you. He turned to Theo. take this piece of shit to the doctor, he said. Get him patched up. He's going to marry my daughter.
Chapter 16. June 1916. Billy's father said, Can we have a chat, boyo? Billy was astonished. For almost 2 years, ever since Billy had stopped attending the Bethesda Chapel, they had hardly spoken. There was always tension in the air at the little house in Wellington Row. Billy had almost forgotten what it was like to hear soft voices talking amiably in the kitchen, or even loud voices raised in the passionate arguments they had used to have. The bad atmosphere was half the reason Billy had joined the army. Dar's tone now was almost humble. Billy looked carefully at his face. His expression told the same story. No aggression, no challenge, just a plea. All the same, Billy was not prepared to dance to his tune. What for? He said. Dar opened his mouth to snap a retort, then visibly controlled himself. I've acted proud, he said. It's a sin. You may have been proud, too, but that's between you and the Lord, and it's no excuse for me. It's taken you 2 years to work that out. It would have took me longer if you hadn't gone in the army. Billy and Tommy had volunteered last year, lying about their age. They had joined the 8th Battalion of the Welsh Rifles, known as the Aberowen Pals. The Pals battalions were a new idea. Men from the same town were kept together to train and fight alongside people with whom they had grown up. It was thought to be good for morale. Billy's group had done a year's training, mostly at a new camp outside Cardiff. He had enjoyed himself. It was easier than coal mining and a lot less dangerous. As well as a certain amount of grinding boredom, training often meant the same as waiting. There had been sports and games, and the camaraderie of a group of young men learning new ways. During a long period with nothing to do, he had picked up a book at random and found himself reading the play Macbeth. To his surprise, he had found the story thrilling and the poetry strangely fascinating. Shakespeare's language was not difficult for someone who had spent so many hours studying the 17th-century English of the Protestant Bible. He had since gone through the complete works, rereading the best plays several times. Now training was over, and the pals had 2 days' leave before going to France. Dar thought this might be the last time he saw Billy alive. That would be why he was humbling himself to talk. Billy looked at the clock. He had come here only to say goodbye to his mother. He was planning to spend his leave in London with his sister Ethel and her sexy lodger. Mildred's pretty face, with her red lips and bunny teeth, had remained vividly in his mind ever since she had shocked him by saying, "Fucking hell, are you Billy?" His kit bag stood on the floor by the door, packed and ready. His complete Shakespeare was in it. Tommy was waiting for him at the station. "I've got a train to catch," he said. "There are plenty of trains," Dar said. "Sit down, Billy. Please." Billy was not comfortable with his father in this mood. Dar might be righteous, arrogant, and harsh, but at least he was strong. Billy did not want to see him weaken. Grandpa was in his usual chair, listening. "Be a good boy now, Billy," he said persuasively. "Give your Da a chance, is it?" "All right, then." Billy sat at the kitchen table. His mother came in from the scullery. There was a moment of silence. Billy knew he might never enter this house again. Coming back from an army camp, he had seen for the first time that his home was small, the rooms dark, the air heavy with coal dust and cooking smells. Most of all, after the free and easy banter of the barracks, he understood that in this house he had been raised to a Bible-black respectability, in which much that was human and natural found no expression. And yet the thought of going made him sad. It was not just the place, it was the life he was leaving. Everything had been simple here. He had believed in God, obeyed his father, and trusted his workmates down the pit. The coal owners were wicked, the union protected the men, and socialism offered a brighter future. But life was not that simple. He might return to Wellington Row, but he would never again be the boy who had lived here. Dar folded his hands, closed his eyes, and said, O Lord, help thy servant to be humble and meek as Jesus was. Then he opened his eyes and said, Why did you do it, Billy? Why did you join up? Because we're at war, Billy said. Like it or not, we have to fight. But can't you see? Dar stopped and held up his hands in a pacific gesture.
Let me start again. You don't believe what you read in the newspapers about the Germans being evil men who rape nuns, do you?
No,
said Billy. Everything the papers ever said about coal miners was lies, so I don't suppose they're telling the truth about the Germans. The way I see it, this is a capitalist war that has got nothing to do with the working man, Dar said. But you may disagree. Billy was amazed by the effort his father was making to be conciliatory. Never before had he heard Dar say, you may disagree. He replied, I don't know much about capitalism, but I expect you're right. All the same, the Germans have got to be stopped. They think they're entitled to rule the world. Dar said, we're British. Our empire holds sway over more than 400 million people. Hardly any of them are entitled to vote. They have no control over their own countries. Ask the average British man why, and he'll say it's our destiny to govern inferior peoples. Dar spread both hands in a gesture that meant, isn't it obvious? Billy boy, it's not the Germans who think they should rule the world. It's us. Billy sighed. He agreed with all this. But we're under attack. The reasons for the war may be wrong, but we have to fight regardless. How many have died in the last 2 years? Dar said. Millions! His voice went up a notch, but he was not angry so much as sad. It will go on as long as young men are willing to kill one another, regardless, as you say. It will go on until someone wins, I suppose. His mother said, I expect you're afraid people will think you're scared.
No,
he said, but she was right. His rational explanations for joining up were not the whole story. As usual, Mam saw into his heart. For almost 2 years he had been hearing and reading that able-bodied young men such as himself were cowards if they did not fight. It was in the newspapers. People said it in the shops and pubs. In Cardiff city centre, pretty girls handed out white feathers to any boy not in uniform. And recruiting sergeants jeered young civilians on the streets. Billy knew it was propaganda, but it affected him just the same. He found it hard to bear the thought that people believed him to be a coward. He fantasized explaining to those girls with white feathers that coal mining was more dangerous than being in the army. Apart from frontline troops, most soldiers were less likely to be killed or injured than miners, and Britain needed the coal. It fueled half the navy. The government had actually said it did not want miners to join up. None of this made any difference. Since he had put on the itchy khaki tunic and trousers, the new boots and the peaked cap, he had felt better. Dar said, people think there's a big push coming at the end of the month. Billy nodded. The officers won't say a word, but everyone else is talking about it. I expect that's why there's a sudden rush to get more men over there. The newspapers say this could be the battle that turns the tide, the beginning of the end. Let's hope so, anyhow. You should have enough ammunition now, thanks to Lloyd George. Aye. Last year there had been a shortage of shells. Newspaper agitation about the shell scandal had almost brought down Prime Minister Asquith. He had formed a coalition government, created the new post of Minister of Munitions, and given the job to the most popular man in the cabinet, David Lloyd George. Since then, production had soared.
Try to take care of yourself, Dar said.
Mam said, don't be a hero. Leave that to them that started the war, the upper classes, the conservatives, the officers. Do as you're told, and no more. Grandpa said,
war is war. There's no safe way to do it.
They were saying their goodbyes. Billy felt an urge to cry and repressed it harshly.
Right then,
he said, standing up. Grandpa shook his hand. Mam kissed him. Dar shook hands, then yielded to an impulse and hugged him. Billy could not remember the last time his father had done that.
God bless and keep you, Billy,
Dar said. There were tears in his eyes. Billy's self-control almost broke.
So long, then,
he said. He picked up his kit bag. He heard his mother sob. Without looking back, he went out, closing the door behind him. He took a deep breath and composed himself. Then he set off down the steep street toward the station. 2. The River Somme meandered from east to west across France on its way to the sea. The front line, running north to south, crossed the river not far from Amiens. South of there, the Allied line was held by French troops all the way to Switzerland. To its north, most of the forces were British and Commonwealth.
From this point, a range of hills ran northwest for 20 miles. The German trenches in this sector had been dug into the slopes of the hills. From one such trench, Walter von Ulrich looked through powerful Zeiss Doppelfernrohr binoculars down to the British positions. It was a sunny day in early summer, and he could hear birdsong. In a nearby orchard that had so far escaped shelling, apple trees were blossoming bravely. Men were the only animals that slaughtered their own kind by the million and turned the landscape into a waste of shell craters and barbed wire. Perhaps the human race would wipe itself out completely and leave the world to the birds and trees, Walter thought apocalyptically. Perhaps that would be for the best. The high position had many advantages, he thought, coming back to practical matters. The British would have to attack uphill. Even more useful was the ability of the Germans to see everything the British were doing, and Walter felt sure that right now they were preparing a major assault. Such activity could hardly be concealed. For months, ominously, the British had been improving the roads and railways in this previously sleepy area of the French countryside. Now they were using those supply lines to bring forward hundreds of heavy guns, thousands of horses, and tens of thousands of men. Behind the front lines, trucks and trains in constant streams were unloading crates of ammunition, barrels of fresh water, and bales of hay. Walter focused his lenses on a communications detail, digging a narrow trench and unspooling a huge reel of what was undoubtedly telephone wire. They must have high hopes, he thought with cold apprehension. The expenditure of men, money, and effort was colossal. It could only be justified if the British thought this was the decisive attack of the war. Walter hoped it was, one way or the other. Whenever he looked into enemy territory, he thought of Maud. The picture he carried in his wallet, cut out of the Tatler magazine, showed her in a dramatically simple ball gown at the Savoy Hotel, over the caption, "Lady Maud Fitzherbert is always dressed in the latest fashion." He guessed she was not doing much dancing now. Had she found some role in the war effort, as Walter's sister Greta had in Berlin, bringing small luxuries to wounded men in army hospitals? Or had she retired to the country, like Walter's mother, and planted her flower beds with potatoes because of the food shortage? He did not know whether the British were short of food. Germany's navy was trapped in port by the British blockade, so there had been no imports by sea for almost 2 years. But the British continued to get supplies from America. German submarines attacked transatlantic ships intermittently, but the High Command held back from an all-out effort, what was called USW for Unrestricted Submarine Warfare, for fear of bringing the Americans into the war. So, Walter guessed, Maud was not as hungry as he was, and he was better off than German civilians. There had been strikes and demonstrations against the food shortage in some cities. He had not written to her, nor she to him. There was no postal service between Germany and Britain. The only chance would come if one of them travelled to a neutral country, the United States or Sweden, perhaps, and posted a letter from there. But that opportunity had not yet arisen for him, nor, presumably, for her. It was torment not to know anything about her. He was tortured by the fear that she might be ill in hospital without his knowledge. He longed for the end of the war so that he could be with her. He desperately wanted Germany to win, of course, but there were times when he felt he would not care about losing as long as Maud was all right. His nightmare was that the end came and he went to London to find her, only to be told that she was dead. He pushed the frightening thought to the back of his mind. He lowered his sights, focused his lenses nearer, and examined the barbed wire defences on the German side of No Man's Land. There were 2 belts of it, each 15 feet wide. The wire was firmly fixed to the ground with iron stakes, so that it could not easily be moved. It made a reassuringly formidable barrier. He climbed down from the trench parapet and turned down a long flight of wooden steps to a deep dugout. The disadvantage of the hillside position was that the trenches were more visible to the enemy artillery, so, to compensate, the dugouts in this sector had been cut far into the chalky soil, deep enough to provide protection from anything but a direct hit from the largest type of shell. There was room to shelter every man in the trench garrison during a bombardment. Some dugouts were interconnected, providing an alternative way out if shelling blocked the entrance. Walter sat on a wooden bench and took out his notebook. For a few minutes, he wrote abbreviated reminders of everything he had seen. His report would confirm other intelligence sources. Secret agents had been warning of what the British called a big push. He made his way through the maze of trenches to the rear. The Germans had constructed three lines of trenches, 2 or 3 kilometers apart, so that if they were driven out of the front line, they could fall back on another trench, and, failing that, a third. Whatever happened, he thought, with considerable satisfaction, there would be no quick victory for the British. Walter found his horse and rode back to Second Army headquarters, arriving at lunchtime. In the officer's mess, he was surprised to encounter his father. The old man was a senior officer on the general staff, and now dashed from one battlefield to another, just as, in peacetime, he had gone from one European capital to the next. Otto looked older. He had lost weight. All Germans had lost weight. His monkish fringe was cut so short that he looked bald, but he seemed spry and cheerful. War suited him. He liked the excitement, the hurry, the quick decisions, and the sense of constant emergency. He never mentioned Maud. "What have you seen?" he asked. "There will be a major assault in this area within the next few weeks," Walter said. His father shook his head skeptically. "The Thorn sector is the best defended part of our line. We hold the upper ground and we have three lines of trenches. In war, you attack at your enemy's weakest point, not his strongest. Even the British know that." Walter related what he had just seen. The trucks, the trains, and the communications detail laying telephone lines. "I believe it's a ruse," said Otto. "If this were the real site of the attack, they would be doing more to conceal their efforts. There will be a feint here, followed by the real assault farther north, in Flanders." Walter said, "What does von Falkenhayn believe?" Erich von Falkenhayn had been chief of staff for almost 2 years. His father smiled. "He believes what I tell him." 3. As coffee was served at the end of lunch, Lady Maud asked Lady Hermia, "In an emergency, Aunt, would you know how to get in touch with Fitz's lawyer?" Aunt Herm looked mildly shocked. "My dear, what should I have to do with lawyers? You never know." Maud turned to the butler as he put the coffee pot down on a silver trivet. "Grout, be so kind as to bring me a sheet of paper and a pencil." Grout went out and returned with writing materials. Maud wrote down the name and address of the family lawyer. "Why do I need this?" Aunt Herm said. "I may get arrested this afternoon," Maud said cheerfully. "If so, do please ask him to come and get me out of jail."
"Oh," said Aunt Herm, "you can't mean it."
"No, I'm sure it won't happen," Maud said, "but, you know, just in case." She kissed her aunt and left the room. Aunt Herm's attitude infuriated Maud, but most women were the same. It was unladylike even to know the name of your lawyer, let alone to understand your rights under the law. No wonder women were mercilessly exploited. Maud put on her hat and gloves and a light summer coat, then went out and caught a bus to Aldgate. She was alone. Chaperoning rules had relaxed since the outbreak of war. It was no longer scandalous for a single woman to go out unescorted in the daytime. Aunt Herm disapproved of the change, but she could not lock Maud up, and she could not appeal to Fitz, who was in France, so she had to accept the situation, albeit with a sour face. Maud was editor of The Soldier's Wife, a small circulation newspaper that campaigned for better treatment for the dependents of servicemen. A Conservative member of Parliament had described the journal as a pestilential nuisance to the government, a quotation that was emblazoned on the masthead of every edition thereafter. Maud's campaigning rage was fueled by her indignation at the subjection of women, combined with her horror at the pointless slaughter of war. Maud subsidized the newspaper out of her small inheritance. She hardly needed the money anyway. Fitz always paid for everything she needed. Ethel Williams was the paper's manager. She had eagerly left the sweatshop for a better wage and a campaigning role. Ethel shared Maud's rage, but had a different set of skills. Maud understood politics at the top. She met cabinet ministers socially and talked to them about the issues of the day. Ethel knew a different political world, the National Union of Garment Workers, the Independent Labour Party, strikes and lockouts and street marches. As appointed, Maud met Ethel across the road from the Aldgate office of the Soldiers and Sailors Families Association. Before the war, this well-meaning charity had enabled well-off ladies to graciously give help and advice to the hard-up wives of servicemen. Now it had a new role. The government paid £1.01 to a soldier's wife with 2 children separated from her husband by the war. This was not much, about half what a coal miner earned, but it was enough to raise millions of women and children out of grinding poverty. The Soldiers and Sailors Families Association administered this separation allowance, but the allowance was payable only to women of good behavior, and the charity ladies sometimes withheld the government money from wives who rejected their advice about child-rearing, household management, and the perils of visiting music halls and drinking gin. Maud thought such women would be better off without the gin, but that did not give anyone the right to push them into penury. She was driven into a fury of outrage by comfortable middle-class people passing judgment on soldiers' wives and depriving them of the means to feed their children. Parliament would not permit such abuse, she thought, if women had the vote. With Ethel were a dozen working-class women plus one man, Bernie Leckwith, secretary of the Aldgate Independent Labour Party. The party approved of Maud's paper and supported its campaigns. When Maud joined the group on the pavement, Ethel was talking to a young man with a notebook. "The separation allowance is not a charitable gift," she said. "Soldiers' wives receive it as of right. Do you have to pass a good conduct test before you get your wages as a reporter? Is Mr. Asquith questioned about how much Madeira he drinks before he can draw his salary as a Member of Parliament? These women are entitled to the money just as if it was a wage." Ethel had found her voice, Maud reflected. She expressed herself simply and vividly. Perhaps she got the talent from her preacher father. The reporter looked admiringly at Ethel. He seemed half in love with her. Rather apologetically, he said, "Your opponents say that a woman should not receive support if she is unfaithful to her soldier husband." "Are you checking on the husbands?" Ethel said indignantly. "I believe there are houses of ill fame in France and Mesopotamia and other places where our men are serving. Does the army take the names of married men entering such houses and withdraw their wages? Adultery is a sin, but it is not a reason to impoverish the sinner and let her children starve." Ethel was carrying her child, Lloyd, on her hip. He was now 16 months old and able to walk, or at least stagger. He had fine dark hair and green eyes, and was as pretty as his mother. Maud put out her hands to take him, and he came to her eagerly. She felt a pang of longing. She almost wished she had become pregnant during her one night with Walter, despite all the trouble it would have caused. She had heard nothing of Walter since the Christmas before last. She did not know whether he was alive or dead. She might already be a widow. She tried not to brood, but dreadful thoughts crept up on her unawares sometimes, and then she had to keep from crying. Ethel finished charming the reporter, then introduced Maud to a young woman with two children clinging to her skirts. "This is Jane McCully, who I told you about." Jane had a pretty face and a determined look. Maud shook hands. "I hope we can get justice for you today, Mrs. McCully," she said. "Very kind of you, I'm sure, ma'am." The habit of deference died hard even in egalitarian political movements. "If we're all ready," said Ethel. Maud handed Lloyd back to Ethel, and together the group crossed the road and went in at the front door of the charity office. There was a reception area where a middle-aged woman sat behind a desk. She looked frightened by the crowd. Maud said to her, "There's nothing to worry about. Mrs. Williams and I are here to see Mrs. Hargreaves, your manager." The receptionist stood up. "I'll see if she's in," she said nervously. Ethel said, "I know she's in. I saw her walk through the door half an hour ago." The receptionist scurried out. The woman who returned with her was less easily intimidated. Mrs. Hargreaves was a stout woman in her 40s, wearing a French coat and skirt and a fashionable hat, decorated with a large, pleated bow. The ensemble lost all its continental chic on her stocky figure, Maud thought cattily, but the woman had the confidence that came with money. She also had a large nose. "Yes," she said rudely. In the struggle for female equality, Maud reflected, sometimes you had to fight women as well as men. "I have come to see you because I'm concerned about your treatment of Mrs. McCully." Mrs. Hargreaves looked startled, no doubt by Maud's upper-class accent. She gave Maud an up-and-down scrutiny. She was probably noting that Maud's clothes were as expensive as her own. When she spoke again, her tone was less arrogant. "I'm afraid I can't discuss individual cases, but Mrs. McCully has asked me to speak to you, and she's here to prove it." Jane McCully said, "That you remember me, Mrs. Hargreaves." "As a matter of fact, I do. You were very discourteous to me." Jane turned to Maud. "I told her to go and poke her nose into someone else's business." The women giggled at the reference to the nose, and Mrs. Hargreaves blushed. Maud said, "But you cannot refuse an application for a separation allowance on the grounds that the applicant was rude to you." Maud controlled her anger and tried to speak with icy disapproval. "Surely you know that." Mrs. Hargreaves tilted her chin defensively. "Mrs. McCallie was seen in the Dog and Duck public house and at the Stepney Music Hall, on both occasions with a young man. The separation allowance is for wives of good conduct. The government does not wish to finance unchaste behaviour." Maud wanted to strangle her. "You seem to misunderstand your role," she said. "It is not for you to refuse payment on suspicion." Mrs. Hargreaves looked a little less sure of herself. Ethel put in, "I suppose Mr. Hargreaves is safe at home, is it?" "No, he's not," the woman replied quickly. "He's with the army in Egypt."
"Oh,"
said Ethel. "So you receive a separation allowance too. That's neither here nor there. Does someone come to your house, Mrs. Hargreaves, to check on your conduct? Do they look at the level of the sherry and the decanter on your sideboard? Are you questioned about your friendship with your grocer's delivery man? How dare you?" Maud said, "Your indignation is understandable, but perhaps now you will appreciate why Mrs. McCallie reacted as she did to your questioning." Mrs. Hargreaves raised her voice. "That's ridiculous. There's no comparison."
"No comparison," said Maud angrily.
"Her husband, like yours, is risking his life for his country. Both you and she claim the separation allowance, but you have the right to judge her behaviour and refuse her the money. Well, no one judges you. Why not? Officers' wives sometimes drink too much." Ethel said, "They commit adultery, too."
"That's it," shouted Mrs. Hargreaves. "I refuse to be insulted."
"So does Jane McCallie," said Ethel. Maud said, "The man you saw with Mrs. McCallie was her brother. He was home on leave from France. He had only 2 days, and she wanted him to enjoy himself before going back to the trenches. That was why she took him to the pub and the music hall." Mrs. Hargreaves looked abashed, but she put on a defiant air. "She should have explained that when I questioned her. And now I must ask you, please, to leave the premises. Now that you know the truth, I trust you will approve Mrs. McCallie's application. We'll see. I insist that you do it here and now."
"Impossible. We're not leaving until you do."
"Then I shall call the police."
"Very well."
Mrs. Hargreaves retreated. Ethel turned to the admiring reporter.
"Where is your photographer?"
"Waiting outside." A few minutes later, a burly middle-aged police constable came in.
Now, ladies," he said. "No trouble, please. Just leave quietly."
Maud stepped forward. "I am refusing to leave," she said. "Never mind about the others."
"And who would you be, madam?"
"I am Lady Maud Fitzherbert, and if you want me to go, you'll have to carry me out."
"If you insist," said the policeman, and he picked her up. As they left the building, the photographer took a picture.
4.
"Aren't you scared?" Mildred said.
"Aye," Billy admitted. "I am, a bit."
He could talk to Mildred. She seemed to know all about him anyway. She had been living with his sister for a couple of years, and women always told each other everything. However, there was something else about Mildred that made him feel comfortable. Aberowen girls were always trying to impress boys, saying things for effect and checking their appearance in mirrors. But Mildred was just herself. She said outrageous things sometimes and made Billy laugh. He felt he could tell her anything. He was almost overwhelmed by how attractive she was. It was not her fair, curly hair or her blue eyes, but her devil-may-care attitude that mesmerized him. Then there was the age difference. She was 23 and he was still not quite 18. She seemed very worldly wise, yet she was frankly interested in him, and that was highly flattering. He looked longingly at her across the room, hoping he would get a chance to talk to her alone, wondering if he would dare to touch her hand, put his arm around her, and kiss her. They were sitting around the square table in Ethel's kitchen, Billy, Tommy, Ethel, and Mildred. It was a warm evening, and the door was open to the backyard. On the flagstone floor, Mildred's 2 little girls were playing with Lloyd. Enid and Lillian were 3 and 4 years old, but Billy had not yet worked out which was which. Because of the children, the women had not wanted to go out, so Billy and Tommy had fetched some bottles of beer from the pub.
"You'll be all right," Mildred said to Billy. "You've been trained."
"Aye."
The training had not done much for Billy's confidence. There had been a lot of marching up and down, saluting, and doing bayonet drills.
He did not feel he had been taught how to survive. Tommy said, if the Germans all turn out to be stuffed dummies tied to posts, we'll know how to stick our bayonets in them. Mildred said, you can shoot your guns, can't you? For a while they had trained with rusted and broken rifles stamped DP for drill purposes, which meant they were not on any account to be fired. But eventually each of them had been given a bolt-action Lee-Enfield rifle with a detachable magazine holding 10 rounds of .303 ammunition. It turned out that Billy could shoot well, being able to empty the magazine in under a minute and still hit a man-sized target at 300 yards. The Lee-Enfield was renowned for its rapid rate of fire, the trainees had been told. The world record was 38 rounds a minute. The equipment is all right, Billy said to Mildred. It's the officers that worry me. So far I haven't met one I'd trust in an emergency down the pit. The good ones are all out in France, I expect, Mildred said optimistically. They let the wankers stay home and do the training. Billy laughed at her choice of words. She had no inhibitions. I hope you're right. What he was really afraid of was that when the Germans started shooting at him, he might turn and run away. That scared him most of all. The humiliation would be worse than a wound, he thought. Sometimes he felt so wrought up about it that he longed for the terrible moment to come so that he would know one way or the other. Anyway, I'm glad you're going to shoot those wicked Germans, Mildred said. They're all rapists. Tommy said, if I were you, I wouldn't believe everything you read in the Daily Mail. They'd have you think all trade unionists are disloyal. I know that's not true. Most of the members of my union branch have volunteered, so the Germans may not be as bad as the Mail paints them. Yeah, you're probably right. Mildred turned back to Billy. Have you seen The Tramp? Aye, I love Charlie Chaplin. Ethel picked up her son. Say goodnight to Uncle Billy. The toddler wriggled in her arms, not wanting to go to bed. Billy remembered him newborn, and the way he had opened his mouth and wailed. How big and strong he seemed now. Good night, Lloyd, he said. Ethel had named him after Lloyd George. Billy was the only person who knew that he also had a middle name, Fitzherbert. It was on his birth certificate, but Ethel had not told anyone else. Billy would have liked to get Earl Fitzherbert in the sights of his Lee-Enfield. Ethel said, he looks like Grandpa, doesn't he? Billy could not see the resemblance. I'll let you know when he grows a mustache. Mildred put her two to bed at the same time. Then the women announced that they wanted supper. Ethel and Tommy went to buy oysters, leaving Billy and Mildred alone. As soon as they had gone, Billy said, I really like you, Mildred. I like you too, she said. So he moved his chair next to hers and kissed her. She kissed him back with enthusiasm. He had done this before. He had kissed several girls in the back row of the Majestic Cinema in Coombe Street. They always opened their mouths straight away, and he did the same now. Mildred pushed him away gently. Not so fast, she said. Do this. And she kissed him with her mouth closed, her lips brushing his cheek and his eyelids and his neck.